Hello and welcome to this AAT podcast covering advanced VAT. This podcast has been designed to accompany the courses that I'll be running for the AAT as part of the Masterclass programme. On the course, I'll be covering a wide variety of topics, including partial exemption and the capital goods scheme, VAT grouping, VAT in international trade, land and buildings, the Halifax principle, and a general case roundup. In this podcast, I'll just concentrate on three of those areas: partial exemption, VAT grouping, and international trade. Let's start with partial exemption. Partial exemption is simply a phrase which is used to describe the situation where a business has a mixture of both taxable and exempt activity. If we recap to our basic provisions, input tax, the VAT on costs, is recoverable insofar as it relates to taxable supplies. So a business that only makes taxable supplies can recover all of the VAT that it incurs, at least in principle. In contrast to this, a business which only makes exempt supplies, such as an insurance company might, doesn't even register for VAT. As a result of that, it can't recover any VAT that it incurs. It bears it all as a cost. Partial exemption, as we've said, is simply the mechanism whereby the business which has a mix of taxable and exempt activities decides how much of its tax it can have back. There are various ways of calculating the VAT that you can recover. The first thing to look at is usually what is referred to as the standard method. The legislation requires you to use the standard method unless you've agreed a special method just for your own business with HMRC. The standard method starts off by doing something which is called direct attribution. All this is looking at your costs on a purchase-by-purchase, invoice-by-invoice basis, and attributing it to the activities in your business. Any VAT which you incur, which relates wholly and exclusively to taxable activity, is recoverable in full. This VAT can be posted directly to the VAT account and recovered. If you have any VAT that relates wholly and exclusively to your exempt activity, this in principle is not recoverable, subject to something called the de minimis limit, which we'll come back to in a minute. In principle, this VAT is put to one side and is likely to be borne as a cost. Other VAT, such as that on overheads, will be apportioned so that you can recover some of the tax on your returns. This attribution exercise is very important, and great care must be taken to ensure that as much tax is recovered at this stage as possible. Once you've done this and you've got your attributed tax, it is that residual tax, the non-attributable tax, that you split. The standard method requires you to do that in a very simple way. It requires you to calculate the value of your taxable income in the VAT return period. You express this as a percentage of your total income in that same period, and you round the resultant figure up to the nearest whole number. So, for example, if you had 92.4% taxable income, then you'd round that up from 92.4 to 93. The only exclusion to this is if you are a very significant business and the residual tax exceeds £400,000 each month. Clearly, for most businesses, that simply isn't relevant. This calculation is done each VAT return period. What then happens is that the VAT that is deemed to be recoverable is put to one side, and we have a look at the value of the exempt input tax. This is made up of two parts: the VAT that we've attributed wholly to exempt activity, and that little bit of the residual tax that we've disallowed as well. This is where that thing called the de minimis rule comes in. If you find that the amount of exempt VAT, that's the VAT you were likely to lose, if you find that that is less than half of your total VAT, and it's also less than £625 per month on average, then you are allowed to recover it as if it related to taxable supplies in the first place. This is a very useful relaxation for the business with relatively low exempt activity. As we've said, this method, calculates the amount of VAT that you're going to recover. And the way it does it is by looking at the value of your income. This is very simple, and in many cases is very, very accurate. However, there are many businesses where the relationship between costs and the income that it produces isn't regular. It may be that a business generates significant amounts of exempt activity and exempt income, but with very little cost. So, for example, a business which has surplus office space might let that office space out. It might decide that it does not wish to charge VAT on that because the tenant in place cannot recover VAT because it's not registered. The chances are that the rent simply arrives in the bank account on a regular basis and that it costs very little to generate it. However, as a percentage of total income, it might be significant. As a result of this, using an income-based method might not be fair. It is open to any business to negotiate a special method with HMRC where it can demonstrate that the standard method is unfair, but that the special method being proposed does give a fair and reasonable apportionment. This is done on a business-by-business basis and is done generally by letter and then through negotiation. Whichever method is in place, the calculation will be done each VAT return period, which for most partially exempt businesses will be quarterly. This could, of course, give rise to quite wide variations across the year. For example, a golf club. A proprietary golf club will be in receipt of exempt fee income in terms of the membership. However, it will also have standard rated income from green fees, from catering, and other outlets such as the bar. It is likely that the exempt fee income, being the membership subscriptions, comes in at one point during the year. For that VAT return period, if income is used as a basis of calculation, there will be a very low VAT recovery. For all of the other quarters, where taxable income is high and exempt income is very low, there will be a very high recovery. It is possible, of course, that some people might take advantage of this. They may seek to accelerate or delay costs so that they are incurred in a period of high recovery rather than incurred in a period of very low recovery. To counter this, there is something called the annual adjustment. Each business, whether it's using a special or the standard method, must carry out an annual adjustment. This takes place at the end of the business's VAT year. This will typically end on either the 31st of March, the 30th of April, or the 31st of May. And this will normally be determined by the business's VAT return periods. Quite simply, the business does an extra calculation. It adds up the four previous sets of figures and does a new calculation based on the total figures. This annual adjustment will be made on the VAT return following the year in question. So, for example, if you have a year that ended on the 31st of March, it would not go on the March return, it would go on the June return. Interestingly, last year, 2009, saw a change to this, where before, in 2009, the delay in putting the VAT adjustment through was mandatory. It is now optional. As a result of this, any businesses that carry out their annual adjustment and find that HMRC owe them money can put it on the last return for the VAT year and not have to wait. Two further changes were made, which are of very great importance. The first is a change to the standard method based on the fact that income is the deciding factor. If your business is growing rapidly or changing rapidly, or is perhaps in a development stage where work is being done but income not generated, to use an income-based scheme might be distortive. Think perhaps of a builder. A builder might buy a site for construction. By the time the builder has bought the site, applied for and gained planning permission, and then carried out the actual build itself, income might not be generated for many, many months, possibly years. For those businesses, the standard method now includes provision for estimates based on future use and future activities. This allows recovery against those future activities and those activities to be taken into account in determining the proportion of VAT to be recovered. The final change that was introduced at April 2009, and which is very important and very useful, is the ability to include non-UK income in a partial exemption calculation. Prior to that date, the 1st of April 2009, if you had income from non-UK sources for such things as consultancy and training, you had to address them separately in your VAT records. If you wished to attribute VAT to those supplies and recover it, you had to do that as a separate calculation. What this meant was that many businesses ended up doing at least two and possibly more calculations every single VAT return period. This clearly was very arduous. The new rule allows all of that income to be put straight into the UK partial exemption calculation. So assuming that your supplies would be taxable if you made them here in the UK, you can simply add them into the value of taxable supplies when calculating your recoverable percentage. One of the other aspects of partial exemption, which is often overlooked, is something called the payback and clawback rules. What we've seen with partial exemption is that you carry out a calculation every VAT return period. And what you're doing is attributing VAT, as far as you possibly can, to one or other particular supplies. That's fine as long as you do eventually make those supplies. Again, let's think about our builder, our developer. It may be that our builder is buying a site with the intention of developing new houses. Again, the intention is to sell those new houses on completion and therefore make a zero-rated taxable supply. Because we can attribute to future as well as current supplies, this means that that builder can recover all of the VAT that he or she incurs throughout the whole process, from acquiring the site all through the planning and development phase up to the point of disposal. That's fine. We attribute our tax, we recover it. What the payback and clawback rules do is just ask a further question. You've attributed VAT in one particular way because of your future intended supplies. What the question is did you ever make those supplies? What happens if that builder builds those nice new houses, but for some reason can't sell them? He's misjudged the market, perhaps, or the market has taken a dive, or maybe he's just simply built the wrong type of property in the wrong place. He may need to attempt to recover some funding by renting the property out. If you rent newly created residential property instead of selling it, you may find that you are, in fact, making exempt supplies. This is where these rules kick in. We've recovered VAT because we intended to make a taxable supply. But before we ever made those taxable supplies, we changed our mind. We changed our intention and we made exempt supplies. What we're required to do is to go back to our original VAT recovery and adjust it. This is a set of rules that is often overlooked. Particularly important in this regard is the fact that you've got to look back a full 6 years when you're looking at these adjustments. Great care needs to be taken if anybody recovers VAT and then changes their mind and makes a different type of supply. Of course, it does work the other way as well, and sometimes it may be that VAT is not recovered because the intended future supply is exempt. But if circumstances change and a taxable supply is made, then that VAT does become recoverable. The final thing that we'll talk about on the course in relation to partial exemption is the capital goods scheme. capital goods scheme is in some ways akin to the payback and clawback rules. The slight difference is that instead of looking at future expected use and change of intention, the capital goods scheme looks at ongoing use and how that use changes over a period of time. It may be that a partially exempt business occupies a building. Perhaps it is their offices. That business is using those offices in its partially exempt business, and its partial exemption recovery percentage may vary from year to year. As a result of that, its use of the asset is changing. The capital goods scheme addresses this. In very broad terms, if any business moves into a property which cost it more than £250,000 plus VAT, or which it has constructed itself, or refurbished, or fitted out, or extended, it is within the capital goods scheme. The business recovers VAT in the normal way in the year in which it incurs the cost. However, for up to 10 years afterwards, it needs to revisit this VAT recovery and adjust it, recovering a little bit extra VAT if its taxable activity increases, paying back a little bit of VAT if its taxable activity decreases. These rules are quite complicated, and businesses need to be very clear about them if they are partly exempt. One of the key areas which affects all businesses is disposal of such buildings. If a building is within the capital goods scheme and the business disposes of it, the disposal will either be taxable or it will be exempt. If it is a taxable disposal because the business has opted to tax, then VAT will obviously be due. The business is deemed to use that building for 100% taxable purposes for any remaining adjustment periods. That business will recover any additional VAT. If the business does not opt to tax, its disposal will be exempt. Again, following the same rule, the business will be deemed to have used that building for exempt purposes for the rest of any remaining periods. The consequence of this is potentially that a very significant amount of VAT will be due back to HMRC. This is something which can impact very severely on what would otherwise be a normal, fully taxable business. It may be that a firm of accountants buys a building for £500,000 plus VAT. It can recover the VAT without any problems whatsoever. It simply puts it on its next VAT return. It's part of its ordinary VAT costs. If it sold that building 5 years later and it didn't charge VAT, then half of the VAT which is incurred would be due back to HMRC immediately. That would be a very large cost for a taxable business, and one which could potentially be quite easily avoided. These and other issues relating to partial exemption and capital goods scheme will be covered in more detail on our course. What I'd like to do now is to move on to another topic, that of VAT grouping. The majority of businesses are registered in their own right. A partnership, a sole trader, a limited company will have its own VAT registration. However, there is something called VAT grouping which is available to corporate bodies. I use the term corporate bodies rather than company because it does extend just that little bit further than ordinary companies. Certainly it includes limited companies, companies limited by guarantee or by share. It also includes such things as LLPs, which are corporate bodies for these purposes. If you have UK corporate bodies under common control, and here we're talking about ordinary Companies Act rules, then they can be registered as one for VAT purposes. This has some interesting effects. If you're VAT registered as one body, all supplies are treated as if they were made by one body. So instead of each company having its own VAT number and charging VAT separately as a result, and reporting it separately on different VAT returns, there's only one VAT number and only one VAT return. All supplies are treated as being made by one person. The other thing, of course, is that you can't trade with yourself. And as a result of that, supplies between corporate bodies within the same VAT group are ignored. You don't have to charge each other VAT. The other really important point to remember, and this is the main downside, is that group VAT members have joint and several liability. As a result of this, if one company goes under and has a significant debt to HMRC, the other companies, the other members, could be held liable. So why does anybody get involved with VAT grouping at all? There are several advantages. The main one, of course, is that point we've already made. Supplies between members are ignored. As a result of that, if you've got a partly exempt company and it is trading with its taxable sisters, when those sister companies make charges to it and charge VAT, you're manufacturing a VAT loss simply by dealing with an associated company. Put them in a VAT group and that VAT charge disappears. And as a result of that, you've saved yourself some VAT immediately. There are other advantages too. As we can see, VAT grouping can be very beneficial. There's no compulsion. You can plan. You may have six companies which are eligible to join a VAT group, but only elect to put four or five in, or even fewer. I came across one organisation a couple of weeks ago that had four companies. Three were taxable companies, and one was almost wholly exempt. The temptation was to put the wholly exempt company into the VAT group to negate the effect of the VAT charges made by those other companies to it. Certainly, if we'd done that, there would have been a VAT saving. But then, of course, the whole group would have become partly exempt. That particular company was a finance company, and it was making some very valuable loans to other people, both within and outside of the group. If we'd put that company into the group, the overall recovery in the group would have plummeted, and it would actually have cost more than the saving we would have made by putting the company in and not having the output tax charge. Whenever planning for VAT groups, it's very, very important to think it through all the way. And of course, you can't just look at historic results and base things on that. You also need to look forward to the business's plans. Are those companies going to change their activities any particular way in the near future? If they do, then grouping might not be attractive. The other thing you've got to be a little bit careful of is the fact that grouping has been used in a very large variety of planning schemes. HMRC are aware of these schemes, and some of them they're happy with, but some of them they feel go a little bit too far. As a result of that, HMRC have given themselves significant powers when it comes to VAT groups. If they feel that a business has taken steps to avoid VAT through the use of grouping, they have the right to take a company which is outside of the group and treat it as if it were in the group all along. They also have the right to take a company which is in the group and treat it as if it never was in the group. And the other thing they can do if they wish is to disregard the basic provisions. If they do this, then any supply between group members, which otherwise would be disregarded, becomes relevant and drops back into the normal VAT charge. VAT grouping, therefore, is a very useful concept, but is one that should only be ever used with great care and thought beforehand. One of the other topics on the course, and which we'll talk about today as well, is international trade. International trade, by its very definition, means that we need to think about other rules other than the standard UK rules. Obviously, Section 4 of the VAT Act tells us that VAT is due on supplies which take place in the UK. Well, if we've got movements of goods either into or out of the UK, is the supply here? Do the normal rules apply? And if we're dealing with services, are those taxed here or are they taxed somewhere else? How do we determine that? Is it because we belong here or we do the work here? Or are there other factors we need to take into account? All of those questions will be answered on the course. For the purposes of today's podcast, I'd like just to talk about goods. Initially, just goods moving around within the EC. The reason I'd like to talk about that today is that there seems to be some confusion over what is zero rated and what is not. Particularly, we need to be very vigilant when it comes to evidence of goods leaving the United Kingdom. There is a zero rating relief for dispatches of goods. The term dispatches simply refers to the movement of goods from one member state to another. There are some key requirements which we must take into account if we wish to gain the zero rating relief. Firstly, it is not sufficient simply for goods to move from one state to another. There are some timing issues, there are some status issues, and there are some evidence issues. Firstly, timing. The goods must leave the member state of dispatch within 3 months of the basic time of supply. This means that if they take longer than that, in principle, the zero rating will not apply. There is an extension of that rule for up to 6 months if the goods are being delivered in the UK, perhaps for some sort of process work to be carried on prior to dispatch. But that 3 month rule is important. The next thing is that we have to be able to prove that the goods have gone. Unlike movements internationally, in and out of the EC, there is no requirement for formal customs declarations on these movements. As a result of that, there is no piece of paper which has got a customs stamp on it which proves that the goods have moved from one state to another. The documentation that we will need will be the sort of documentation which your carriers provide to you. Delivery notes, that sort of thing. We need some piece of paper which proves that the goods physically left the UK. HMRC suggests that you need, as a minimum, some sort of evidence of the date the goods move, where they're supposed to be going. If they're going by vehicle, road vehicle, the registration number of that vehicle. We need a delivery address. Ideally, we need some sort of proof of the route, perhaps which ferry or shipping company was used. Always need to prove that the goods have gone. Finally, we mentioned some status issues. You can only zero rate a dispatch where your customer is validly VAT registered in another member state and provides you with that VAT registration number. You should check that VAT registration number using the online service. The Europa website has a VIES section, the Value Added Tax Information Exchange System. Click on there and insert the VAT number which you have been given by your customer. That service will tell you whether that is a valid VAT number. Once you've got that backup, that evidence, that support, that you've got an eligible VAT number, then you can think about zero rating your supply. The only other real consideration you need to fulfil is to insert that VAT number on your VAT sales invoice. Make sure that it is shown there, along with the two-character country identification code for the customer. Those sales will be reported on a UK VAT return. They will be entered as sales, as just like any other sale, in Box 6. They'll also be entered in Box 8 of your VAT return. Box 8 is only ever used for these types of supplies. One of the key changes on European sales lists is for those businesses with significant values of dispatches. In 2009 and earlier, ESLs were submitted on a calendar quarter basis, and that was for all businesses. From 1st of January 2010, the rule is different. If the value of your monthly dispatches exceeds £70,000, then you are required to submit monthly ESLs. If your value is below that, then you can continue with the quarterly forms. This is going to be a major burden on a lot of businesses. That covers goods leaving the UK and going to another member state. Similar provisions apply in the other member states for goods leaving those states and arriving here in the UK. When goods arrive in the UK in this way, they are, as a result of what we've been talking about, free of any VAT charge. However, that is not the end of the story. A VAT charge does need to be levied on standard-rated goods. The mechanism for this is that the customer accounts for the VAT on their own VAT return. This is usually referred to as the postponed accounting system. The customer calculates the amount of VAT which would have been charged had the goods been supplied in the UK initially. Thus, if £1,000 worth of goods are brought into the UK from, say, Belgium, VAT of £175 is due. The business puts that £175 of tax in box 2 of its VAT return. That's the only time anything goes in box 2 of a VAT return. The business can then ask itself a further question. It can ask itself, if we'd incurred £175 with VAT in the UK, would we have been allowed to recover it on a VAT return? Assuming that the answer is yes, and of course that will be the answer for the majority of businesses, then that's exactly what it does. It puts the same amount, in our example £175, into box 4 of the same VAT return. The overall effect, of course, is absolutely zero. But that's what you've got to do. Please make sure that all the businesses we're involved with do carry out these calculations, as it is important. On the course, we'll go into more detail on these factors, and we'll also look at the movement of goods internationally. From 1st of January, there have been some very important changes in this regard, and indeed, one of the major things for those businesses is the introduction of the European sales list for services for the first time. Again, this is a major burden on businesses, and businesses need to be geared up for this and make sure that they are complying. Further details will be on the course, and as mentioned earlier, we'll be looking at some other areas of VAT law which give rise to particular issues. Land and property is a particular area of difficulty, and we'll spend some time there looking at individual issues and transactions that might give rise to difficulties. I hope to see you on the course. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast.